This is Monocle on Design, and I'm Josh Fennett. On today's show, we talk through a few architectural headlines with Oliver Wainwright of The Guardian newspaper. Plus,
it's just empowering for me to know that from all over the world we are practicing, and people will take note of that and be encouraged and be resilient and work more towards the good of architecture and the society.
We also find out how architecture awards can work as a platform for underrepresented talent. And we head to New York's MoMA to peruse a retrospective of a late Congolese artist, engineer, designer, and imaginer of the built environment. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design. Do stay tuned. First up, a rundown of the architectural headlines. I recently had the pleasure of sitting down with Oliver Wainwright. He's The Guardian's architecture and design critic, and we discussed a digest of overlooked stories from Ramallah to the Rill in South London and what to do with a burnt-out building in Glasgow.
I just got back from Ramallah, actually. I had a fascinating week in the West Bank, seeing, I suppose, the side of Palestine that isn't often in Western media. And actually, the first thing they told me when I arrived, they said, "You're the only foreign journalist who's bothered to come because it's a good news story." They said they'd approached The Guardian's Jerusalem correspondent, and because it wasn't about conflict and disaster, they hadn't turned up. So it was a new cultural centre in Ramallah called the A.M. Katan Foundation, a $20 million kind of beacon built on the hillside that contains a new gallery, library, artist studio space, a new theatre, performance offices for the foundation, you know, this kind of multicultural centre which the West Bank has never had access to. And there are hundreds of facilities like this just across the border, and yet Ramallah has never had anything like that. So it's a real kind of symbol of hope and, yeah, unlikely optimism.
Well, I suppose one of the problems when you're living in an occupied nation on a very controversial strip of land, which means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, as museums do in their way, just the act of building, of constructing something, can become a big problem. And you mentioned in your rather wonderful piece that it's not quite finished yet. It's not quite there yet. Maybe, perhaps, as an idea, we'll come on to that in a moment, but also as a physical structure. So there was a competition, Seville-based architecture practice won it. What was it like to visit? And tell us the state of repair or disrepair you found it in.
Well, it was fascinating, actually, speaking to the Seville architects. They said so many of the materials that they'd specified for this project had either yet to arrive or had been held up for months at the border or mysteriously incurred extra customs charges when they arrived in Israel. So, you know, it's such a kind of abuse of power. They're used to the everyday harassment that they get from the Israeli Defense Force, you know, always having to show their permits to move around the country. But the fact that the internationally graded materials, so, you know, the best fire alarm that you can buy from Austria was forbidden to enter Palestine. The shelves for the library were held in customs for 3 months. And so, yeah, building under occupation is unlike building anywhere else in the world. Another struggle the architects had, they said it had been 3.5 years of fighting for anything like the quality they wanted, because they said actually a lot of Palestinian labourers work in Israel because wages there are 2 to 3 times what they are locally. So they're left with the less skilled workforce and trying to enforce these, you know, perfect joints between blocks of limestone and the little shadow gaps and the kinds of things that Spanish architects obsess over. It was clearly very difficult to achieve in that context.
It's a strange thing. A couple of years ago, there was a Palestinian museum which was opened. That was eventually kind of undermined a little bit by infighting. The problem here is basically trying to forge a coherent narrative of identity, as you kind of mentioned before the interview, telling a positive story about a place. And I get the sense from your writing that you actually were rather impressed by it. You can correct me if you think I'm wrong.
And actually I was there 2 years ago for the opening of the Palestinian Museum as well. And I suppose what really annoyed me about that is that for once, a lot of international journalists did come. And all of the headlines said, "Palestinian Museum opens, but there's nothing inside it." And they all focused on the fact that there was no collection, again, because it was very difficult to bring in objects through the current high security border situation. And I suppose I wanted to go and actually just tell the more positive, untold side. You know, the Palestinian Museum is an incredible building. by Hinnig and Peng Architects based in Dublin. And similarly, the Catan Foundation, they've done a very impressive job. I mean, the construction quality is probably not quite up to Palestinian museum standards, but it's still way ahead of most things in Ramallah.
And just the final thing on this project, I thought it was rather poignant that you mentioned maybe the lack of infrastructure around it. You know, they're thinking of laying on a tour bus so people can come and see it. I mean, you know, when we think about the built environment and we think about architecture, there is rather a lot of spectacle around at the moment. And I wonder if there's a sense that it's maybe not as well connected to the surrounding area. It's a beacon for it, but is it for it?
Exactly. I mean, the foundation used to have a very central headquarters in an old 1930s orphanage, and they'd spent years trying to acquire the neighbouring site and do a kind of subtle, sensitive extension to provide the same facilities on the site in the centre of the city. The landowner refused to sell, and now, lo and behold, there's a kind of 30-storey luxury hotel built on that site. So this was the closest piece of land the foundation could buy to the city. And at the moment, it does feel a little bit out of the centre. It's a good half an hour walk. It's in a kind of residential suburb. Interestingly enough, Ramallah is growing at such a rate that in a few years, it probably won't feel quite so peripheral. You know, the city will have expanded to swallow it. So yeah, I'm optimistic.
I want to move on to rather, I'm going to call it a lighthearted story, but I sense that you think there's a bit of a consequence to it. This is the story of the rill, which is a rather beautiful word, but is also a 260-metre long watery fissure, I believe is the phrase used to describe it, which runs from Tooley Street on the site of a former tributary to the Thames. So it's basically a gutter, but with a little bit of thought behind it, and it's being concreted over. Why have you found this so irksome?
It's a glorified gutter. Well, I think it struck a chord with me because I used to work at the Greater London Authority, and every day, you know, I'd come from the station and follow this little water feature towards City Hall. And to be honest, it was the one tiny moment of delight in what was otherwise an incredibly bleak, grey landscape. And just having this little trickle of water, which even back then, you know, I was surprised it had made it through planning, given current health and safety paranoia. You know, you would often see people accidentally walking in it, which was actually quite funny. And so, yeah, now it's finally been filled in after 16 years of providing a tiny bit of delight to this privately owned public space. It's been decreed to be too much of a hazard. And it's interesting, a lot of people are blaming it on millennials. They're saying, oh, all these young people walking around staring at their mobile phones, tripping up, which I don't think is true at all. I think it just cost them too much to maintain a water feature, and it was much easier to brick it up.
We have a final story here, which is, again, a little bit serious in tone, but, you know, every problem is an opportunity. There was a fire that ravaged the Glasgow Art School. Mm. It's obviously a wonderful example of Art Deco architecture. Is it Art Nouveau? You can tell me.
It's Art Nouveau, but actually the later phase is veering towards Deco. So
okay,
the
lines are beginning to straighten
exactly
by the time Mr. McIntosh is in town. So ravaged by a fire, it's a terrible thing, but it's inspired a rather fierce debate around what to do with it. I imagine a lot has changed in pedagogy and in architecture since 1896.
Oh yeah.
Could there be a better building that goes on the site of it, or should we renovate it? What do you think?
It's a very difficult question. I think actually the problem is the debate has already polarised between knock it down and build something new, or restore it exactly as it was. And I think actually there's probably a much more subtle middle ground. If you look at a project like David Chipperfield and Julian Harrop's Neues Museum in Berlin, you know, which was the site of a kind of bomb-ravaged museum, and they've done a very clever project that kind of both celebrated the kind of ruined quality of some of the building, restored other elements to exactly as they were, and then had some quite striking, contrasting modern additions. And I think if we can get architects of that caliber, you know, through an open international competition and a slow approach, that's crucial. You know, I don't think we should rush into whatever happens next, but, you know, taking our time to work out the best possible approach, I think that middle ground probably be the best way forward.
I think you're probably right, but I'm going to press you because I think you got a quotes from a lot of different sides. You did your journalistic duty by it and heard everyone out.
Yeah.
Is this something that you imagine will drag on and continue to be polarised, or is there an option where I think a school of art should be the conceptual equivalent that we can all agree on? You know, should it be a place of experimentation, and is that going to happen, do you think?
Well, it's a particularly interesting site, I suppose, because McIntosh himself was so forward-thinking. A lot of people have said he wouldn't want a replica built. You know, if he was around today, he would be building the art school of the future, and definitely not something.
He'd be eating Walker's crisps, he'd be drinking Coke, he'd be having a great time.
But I think the counter argument to that is just look across the street at what we have built recently, which is the Stephen Hall extension. this great kind of refrigerator of a building that, you know, lumbers across the street with all the elegance of an out-of-town cineplex. You know, it shows no sensitivity to its context. It's incredibly coarsely detailed and kind of just... It's an abomination. It won the Private Eye medal for the worst building of the year. And you know, there's a very real danger that if we have another international competition and get, you know, the Starkitect of the day to come and do a new Glasgow School of Art, we'll end up with something like that.
Many thanks to Oliver Wainwright there. He's the architecture and design critic at The Guardian newspaper here in London. Next up, we hit the red carpet for the inaugural Dorfman Award. Architects are no strangers to prizes, and while the winners are often worthy, these awards can feel rather similar. The victors all too often hail from Western countries, with their work adorning vast cities dominated by glass skylines. So why did the Royal Academy in London decide the world needed another accolade, and who were they looking to laud? The stated aim of the Dorfman Award is to champion global talent that represents the future of architecture. And with this year's shortlisters hailing from Colombia, Ethiopia, Iran, Japan, and Bahrain, our curiosity led us to its first prize-giving earlier this month. Monocle's Christy Evans, this show's ever-patient editor no less, reports.
Five different practices from five different countries vying for one award. It's been a day of presentations as the finalists portray not just their work, but themselves and their practices as well. A discussion takes place as the jury deliberate on the winner, and a striking aspect of the event becomes evident.
As of course there are huge differences in your conditions of practice with regard to the specifics of your respective local, geographic, social, political and economic contexts. Each of you are on the path to be leaders and inspirers in the coming generation of practitioners, and as such, we're definitely positive that you will all promote the discussion of architecture in this role in society.
The future of architecture is a societal one.
You have to do something. There is no way of not engaging.
Felipe is 1/6 of Arquitectura Expandida, a design collective based in Bogota, Colombia. The group work on a part-time basis alongside their day jobs to help the community grow.
Before professionals or whatever discipline you are in, you are a citizen. And being so implies, of course it's not mandatory, but implies of exercising your duties of claiming your rights. And our particular take on that, it is the culture and the arts are not luxuries, are a right that citizens should be allowed to enjoy. And we understood that through our technical skills, it was possible. Architecture is just, let's say, a tool. I could have been an economist, I guess, and I would have been doing something similar, I guess. It's just like it's so much in your face, in your reality, you just cannot avoid. It would be irresponsible just to avoid that reality and not attempting to change it. When you have a group of people in a peripheral district of Bogota with over a million of inhabitants and they don't have a single cinema, so you just come together and you plan and you fulfill your objective, which is building a cinema, a community cinema, which is managed by the community, and then you also make a statement and you shout at local authorities, national authorities. Now it's very common to hear the 99% against the 1%. Yes, okay, so we decided to be architects for the 99%.
And of course there are many things that as an architect you can't change. Bureaucracy, corruption. How do you get around these things when you want to build, say, a cinema for the locals?
I mean, corruption, it's of course, is a local reality. I don't know if it's the cause of the manifestation of inequality, but greed, of course, we were discussing this morning that before inequality, you have also greed, so people that want to take everything. Maybe corruption is also a way. Of course, it is a way greed manifestates. So we have big problems, mafia, narco-traffic, violence, fear, you know, depletion of collective and individual rights. So this is some sort of shout out to just say, okay, there are other ways to resist. It's some sort of, we aligned how, I think it was, I don't know if it was David Harvey who said it, but some sort of creative resistance, you know, is not only about clashing, but clashing with proposing something, acting. So in a way, of course, we are mediated by many, many conflicted situations, but we try to make the most out of it.
Not only do architects in developing countries have bureaucratic differences to face, but environmental. Rahel Scholl's practice is based in Ethiopia.
We are used to architecture that is modern, contemporary, but relevant to the environment, like not so many glass walls, because we don't use air conditioning, and very understated buildings and projects that bring value to people. But also in other developments, it is just making projects that are environmentally fit. We have beautiful topographies connecting the exterior with the interior, using very local materials, for example, in the construction process, like stone. Stonework is very, very used in Ethiopia. Craft of stonework is really great. So those kinds of architecture design ideas are fit in the environment. So
I know that you work a lot with emerging architects. You do a lot of mentoring, advising. What kind of architect do you hope to see at this award in a few years' time?
Yeah, I mean, especially from our continent, let's say, I know and I hope that a language that is African in architecture will come out. You know, we have very modern developing cities, so could be urban ideas, you know, changes in many ways could be bigger scale, smaller works, but, you know, just architecture that is beautiful, that talks about language, that is hopefully researched and experimental based, because we don't do that. There's no time and finance and all that, but in the future, I hope that more young emerging architects can be able to talk about a language of architecture that is Ethiopian and that is very contextual to our situations. You know, a whole lot of people are looking at it back home, so it's just empowering for me to know that even in contexts like this, from all over the world, we are practicing, and people will take note of that and be encouraged and be resilient and work more towards the good of architecture and the society. So thank you for having me here.
It seems each candidate has gained something by being here, but only one person can walk away with the prize.
It's my great pleasure to tell you that the winner is Eliezer Tegelbaum.
Iranian architect Eliezer Tegelbaum has the honour of being the first ever recipient of the Royal Academy Dorfman Award.
Of course, I'm very happy. The notable judge is very impressive.
Your practice is called Next Office. Could you tell me a bit about what your practice aims to do with its architecture?
Within the practice, we are interested in making positive and productive actions from contradictions. Contradictions that exist within the social context. It is interesting to be productive within the contradictions and conflicts. Things that separate people like race, religion, culture.
So obviously this is the first year the award has been in existence. First of all, how important is this kind of award to you, and what is it you wanted to prove, or what is it you wanted to show by being here and by presenting yourself and your body of work?
So the world going towards multipolarity, it's a very interesting notion that maybe today was a proof of that. And the fact that there are a lot of discussions going parallel to discussions which are dominant on the West is quite interesting to observe.
That was Christy Evans reporting from the very first Royal Academy Dorfman Award right here in London. Next up, we set sail for New York. Bodies Izek Kingeles was a designer, artist, engineer and visionary who was born and raised in the Belgian Congo, today's Democratic Republic of Congo. His long-overlooked work re-envisioned the urban landscape on a mini-scale in installations of colourful utopian cityscapes. The style of these creations blends everything from Art Deco turns to modernism, often incorporating found items along the way. Kingalez died in 2015, but his first retrospective in the US is currently on show at New York's Museum of Modern Art, the first time, it should be noted, that the museum has held a solo show for a black African artist. The show, entitled City Dreams, runs until January the 1st of next year, and Monocle's Ed Stocker spoke to the curator, Sarah Suzuki, to find out more about Kingalez's unlikely, alluring, and long-overlooked oeuvre.
Bodas Isaac Kingalez was an artist whose work I first saw in 2002. I remember it incredibly clearly. I was at Documenta in Kassel, Germany, and the work that I saw is actually here in the exhibition. It's called Vie Fantôme, and it's just a few feet from where we're standing right now. But I remember in that moment being so incredibly struck by the beauty and the intricacy and the optimism that that work contained. And a little bit of research revealed that I was not the only one, certainly, that found this work so fascinating. From the time of his kind of international debut in 1989, Bodas had been included in a number of important group exhibitions, important biennials, shows like The Short Century, which was organized by Okwe and Weiser. And in fact, in 1997, he was part of a projects exhibition here at MoMA. It was a group show. I think it was about six artists. He had three works in that show. So in a way, he was a known quantity. We started working on the show about 2 years ago, and it just felt that the ideas that are contained within this body of work, ideas about how we might be able to live together more cooperatively, ways to put ourselves in dialogue in order to achieve a more harmonious, a more successful, a more peaceful future. It seemed like though they were Bodas's concerns in the 80s, in the 90s, in the 2000s, they're just as urgent today as they were then. And so it just seems like a really wonderful moment to bring this work to New York.
Let's have a wander, shall we? And have a look at this artwork we were just referencing a moment ago in front of us. I mean, what's incredible about his work is the sort of mishmash now of materials that he uses.
Yeah, it is a really incredible bringing together of all kinds of totally quotidian things and almost a kind of alchemical transformation of them into something really magical. This work is a work that dates from a little bit later in his career. So it was in a moment when he was able to acquire new materials, which he often then put into dialogue with found materials. And when I say new materials, he would go to the hardware store, to the stationery store, and he would buy there the kinds of things that appeal to him. So this is actually a really great one. This is set in the year 3009, and Set is a real town in the south of France. It's a beautiful maritime city, and Bodas spent about a month there making this work specifically for them. So if you look, you'll see that there are actually things that are very true to that city, and then there are materials that are very specific to that experience. So you'll see in this one in particular, he's using these kind of bubble letter shaped stickers, like there's an H right there, he puts his initials on some things. That was a material he acquired on this trip, and you never see that reappear in any of the other work.
Maybe we can talk a little bit about the context in which he rose to prominence, that post independence, positivity that feeds into his work.
Yeah, it's an excellent point. Bodas is born in 1948 in an agricultural village called Kimbembele Ohunga, and that is actually the title of a couple of works in this exhibition. And so he kind of comes of age really as the events of independence are taking place in what had been the Belgian Congo. And there is for him, and definitely built into the work at that time, a tremendous optimism about the idea of nation building, about the idea of Zaireans, what would become Zaire, of people making a country that was for, of, by, and about them, their culture, their traditions, their beliefs, and the hope for a really bright future. The work that he makes is always about the idea of the communal and the community. You never find a mansion, you never find a palace. Instead, you find universities, you find churches, you find supermarkets, you find town squares. They're really about the idea of kind of a civic life and a civic responsibility, which is something he really believed in strongly.
I mean, looking at these works, they're very eclectic, lots of colours, a whole host of different styles. But given this sort of optimism, this desire to recreate the urban landscape, can we put them in the same class as other post-independence Pan-African modernists?
I think it's a really interesting question. And, you know, this is actually the first full retrospective of Kingles's work anywhere in the world. So one of the things that we really endeavored to do in our research and in the show was to really dive deeply into Kingles's specific milieu and to try to understand the ideas, the events, the locations that would have helped to shape his vision and who he really was, with the idea of trying to get specific about Kingles. And in fact, it's in that kind of framework that you start to understand what Kinshasa looked like as a city, which is where he spent the entirety of his mature career. That was a place that had a very layered history, in particular architectural history. So you have the Deco buildings that were constructed by the Belgians. You have the kind of rigid Germanic influence. And then you have the incredibly ambitious architecture that starts to come up post-independence, which Mobutu and others really see as a means of communicating the ambition and the achievement of these new governments. So you start to understand that, yes, he's very much part of a generation that's experiencing a sea change on their continent. And at the same time, these works, as we were saying before, are so locally specific and are really about his set of influences and experiences. Some of my favorite works in the exhibition, they are Kinshasa La Belle, which is a beautiful round building. And it's actually a play on a nickname that was given to Kinshasa. Kinshasa was called Kinshasa La Belle, Kinshasa the Beautiful. And as the situation deteriorated in Kinshasa into the 80s and 90s, the kind of sarcastic play on that became Kinshasa La Poubelle, Kinshasa the kind of trash can. It's one of the reasons we actually don't translate the Kingles titles, is because they very often have these kinds of puns built into them, which our translations would just decimate. But Kingles said about this, that this is Kinshasa as planned by Kingles, infinitely more beautiful. And he envisioned these blue forms as kind of butterflies covering the surface of this kind of cylindrical structure. Centrale Palestinienne, which is here in the front, to me is one of the works that's really emblematic and has helped us to kind of reframe one of the commonly, I think, misunderstood things about Kingles. So it's often said that he was a visionary artist and he worked in total isolation, that his inspiration came solely from some divine source. And in fact, so much of the work responds to precisely what is happening either in the city or in the broader world around him.
Social issues.
Right? Absolutely. Social issues, the front page of the paper. This work, Centrale Palestinienne, was made just a couple of months after the Oslo Accord was signed. So you can think about it very much in response to kind of the changing geopolitical landscape and the idea of making this kind of homage. You'll see over the lintel it says Jericho, with this kind of minaret on top. So even referring specifically to a kind of nationally specific kind of architecture. And when it comes around, you will see that he also used camel cigarette boxes in this work. But if you take the idea of the camel and you divorce it from the cigarette, it becomes about the idea of the flora and fauna of this specific region. So it's actually, I think, like a really funny reuse of that material. But
a Middle Eastern reference through the camel.
Absolutely, absolutely. A reference to the specific place that he's thinking about in the making of this work.
Our many and sincere thanks to Ed Stocker there, who was speaking to MoMA's Sarah Suzuki about City Dreams, a retrospective of the work of the Congolese artist Bodies Izek Kingles, which runs until January 2019. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. However, next week,
I think we matured through doing competitions and learned how to be more successful in it. It's important because the truth is that in Greece, we only get to do small things.
Athens is on the up. We head to Greece for a peek inside the studios of the capital's best and brightest in design and architecture. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.